We're going to go ahead and get started. My name is Mark Grant, and I'm a lawyer in the technology industry, and I've been following a number of lawsuits that have been filed over the past year and a half that generally relate to a company called SCOS, rights in certain software called Unix, an operating system, which you may, hopefully if you're here, you know what that is, and you have some inkling of what the topic is. And if you don't, there are plenty of other fun things you could be doing right now with your time. But for those of you that are interested, this is a really important topic. It's important because of the growing use of open source software, in particular the Linux operating system or platform, and some of the problems that can arise legally if you use those sorts of platforms, open source software, not just operating systems, but applications as well. And this lawsuit or a series of lawsuits is an example of something to keep in mind when using open source software. I'm an attorney. I've been practicing for about 5 years. I just left private practice, so I'm not for hire. But if you need some help, I can point you in the right direction to find some lawyers that may be able to help you. So this is a presentation for your education. It's not legal advice, and I hope that you find it informative. We're going to talk about a couple different things. First, a little background about who SCO is, which you may or may not know. And then we'll mostly talk about this first lawsuit, which involves IBM. And claims that IBM has taken parts of SCO's protected source code in Unix and integrated it into Linux. And we'll talk about that at great length. A major theme that we'll explore in talking about that, I want to give you some background so you understand what is going on in the lawsuit. There are a lot of things that happen in a lawsuit that are really, frankly, rather boring. I'm not a litigator, but I can tell you about where things are, where things stand currently, and where they're going. And the short version is that it's going very slowly, but that's to be expected in a lawsuit where the damages that have been alleged exceed $5 billion. And IBM is taking the lawsuit pretty seriously. We'll talk about another set of lawsuits that SCO has either filed or been sued by other companies that all generally relate to the same topic. And that's what we plan to do in the time that we have together. So before we begin, one thing that helps me help you is to understand a little bit more about who you are. So by show of hands, I'd like to know a couple things. First of all, I'm curious how many people here use Linux? How many people use Linux for their businesses? Okay. How many people here are actual developers, software developers? Okay, good. Any lawyers? Okay. How about SCO employees? There aren't too many out here on the East Coast. Any IBMers? Okay, great. How about any Microsoft employees? Right. Okay, good. So let's talk about SCO. You may or may not have heard from them recently. SCO has basically since last spring begun a very aggressive campaign to protect their alleged intellectual property rights in an old software platform called Unix, which you're probably familiar with. Unix is the granddaddy or grandma operating system that's been used for a long, long time, probably definitely since before I was born, probably since before you were born or many of you were born as well. It is a fantastic operating system. I'm using a Mac here, and the kernel in the current Macintosh operating system is not based on the original Linux. It's based on BSD, a version of it. But it's industrial strength software. It's really powerful stuff. It's used to literally run businesses and factories. It's a fantastic operating system, and it's been around and withstood the test of time. What that means is that you don't run into a lot of the bugs and problems that you might if you're running, say, Windows, which is an operating system that has problems. That, in fairness, when you consider how long Unix has been around, it makes sense that there should be fewer bugs given how old the software is and how long people have had to basically kick the tires and work out problems with it. So setting aside any issues you may have with Windows, it just makes sense that it would be a better operating system. It's been around for a long, long time. So we'll talk in a second about how SCO ended up with rights in Unix. But the important thing, the relatively recent event, is that SCO, amongst the letters that they sent out, they filed a lawsuit against IBM. Basically, a spring, a year and a half ago, at the same time they're sending out all these letters. And the last count I heard, they had sent out letters to about 3,000 different companies. To my knowledge, they haven't really tried to sue any individuals or try and seek fees. But their strategy here at a very high level, what they're trying to do is they're trying to monetize, they're trying to basically generate money for an asset that they bought, which is Unix. And that in and of itself is something that a lot of companies would try and do. What is, I think, particularly vexing about the lawsuit is the manner in which they're doing it. Basically, that's one part of it. And the other question is whether or not they really have any claim at all. And that's really the central question that we'll explore. There, on the one hand, I think we probably all agree, and maybe not everyone, but we'd agree that when you make something, software, and somebody steals it and exploits it, that's bad, and that hurts you, and you should be able to protect yourself against people taking your stuff, your code, and pirating it and selling it to other people. That's like one end of the spectrum, which I think generally people would all agree that that's not all that bad. The other end of the spectrum is it's really, really bad to scare people and threaten them with a lawsuit when there really may not be much of a claim behind the lawsuit. And we'll call that FUD, fear, uncertainty, and doubt. And a lot of the pundits that you may have read about in articles about this think that the SCO lawsuit may be more in that direction. But truth be told, it's really going to be difficult for anyone to say, given the amount of protection, which is fair. If SCO had concerns about protecting their IP rights, the last thing in the world that they would want to do is to take the source code for their software applications, in this case Unix, and publicize it, so that way it would be much more challenging for them to basically fully protect themselves. One of the big ways that software developers protect themselves is by not disclosing the source code for their software. And the reason is because executable code is awfully difficult to basically reverse engineer into code, software code that people can easily read and work with. And that's a very practical way to make sure that people aren't doing things with your stuff when it comes to software. And in addition to that, there are legal protections as well that flow in the software industry from doing that. We'll talk about a number, basically two different IP rights that are relevant to this particular issue. One of them is what's called a trade secret. And the idea behind a trade secret is, the best way to think about it is, think about the formula for Coca-Cola, something that's been around for a long, long time, and it's awfully difficult for people to figure out how they make Coke, the secret sauce, so to speak. The law protects trade secrets so long as you've taken reasonable steps to keep your secret a secret, and it's valuable because it's a secret. And then when someone else comes along and steals your secret, they get access to the secret sauce, then you can sue them and stop them from doing that. Now, the way that works in the software world is that because it's so difficult to reverse engineer executable code, which is essentially binary, ones, zeros, etc., there are some people that can do that. But there aren't many of them around, and it's a very time-consuming process. One way that a software developer can protect himself or herself or their company is by claiming that's a natural way of protecting the secrets in your source code, the code that you can actually read. And that's something that's relevant to this particular lawsuit. The other thing, by the way, that we'll talk about is known as copyrights. And copyrights are very different than trade secrets. In terms of something to think about, when you think about a copyright, think about how you stop somebody from stealing your book or your music, if you write music or you compose, or other things. And there are some problems with applying copyright, frankly, applying any kind of IP right to software, because all the various forms of intellectual property laws were generated a long time before there was anything resembling a computer. So there have been a lot of problems in translation, trying to make the law fit to protect software. So we'll talk a little bit more about those as we proceed. But let's talk about who SCO is. SCO is, at least about a year ago, they were known as Caldera Systems Incorporated, and they did business under the name SCO Group. I think they may have changed their name since then. They're based out in Utah. And originally, Caldera, a long time ago, developed a version of Unix, that operating system I was talking about before, and they developed a version that was compatible with Intel processors. Unix originally ran on big iron, ran on large server-style computers, mainframes, etc. It wasn't designed for personal computers. And what Caldera did was basically generated a version for a PC, for an Intel processor-based computer. Now, in 1992, by the way, one other thing about Unix, which you may or may not know, Unix was developed by AT&T forever, basically, until 1992, when a software company called Novell bought all of the rights in Unix from AT&T, and then they called it UnixWare. But they didn't really get very far with that as an asset. What they did in 1995, 3 years later, was they sold most of the rights, perhaps all of the rights, depending on who you talk to, and we'll explain what I mean about that. Some of you may know already, but they sold a lot of the rights in Unix to this company called Santa Cruz Operation, which turned around very quickly and sold it to Caldera. And Caldera saw a lot of value in the name SCO, Santa Cruz Operation, and that's why they decided to stick with that name, to basically capitalize on the value of that name in the marketplace. And they did that in 2002. So, in this lawsuit that was filed in 2003, SCO claimed a number of things. And let me say something, and it's something I'll mention a little bit more in a little bit more detail in a few minutes. But there's this idea when you bring a lawsuit, and I'm not a litigator, but I've worked with litigators. Litigators are the kind of lawyers that actually go into court, and they sue people or they defend people from getting sued. And there are basically two schools of thought about what you do when you file a lawsuit in terms of strategy. One strategy, think about rifles. The idea is that you want people to focus on the problem. It's the idea is you focus on the main issue, and you don't want to let anything distract the people that are judging the case, the judge or the jury, from the point that you're trying to make. You try and keep your position very focused. Then there's this idea of what I call a shotgun. And think about not a shotgun at close range, but say a shotgun 60 feet away, where there's this wide spread of things that may or may not hit you. And the idea behind these kinds of lawsuits is that you know that what the other side did was bad. You're not entirely sure which arrow in your quiver is going to stick in them when you get to court, so you claim many different things. And that's exactly what has happened in the SCO lawsuit. And IBM, by the way, has responded in turn, which is, in some ways, what makes this lawsuit fun is a word I would rarely, if ever, associate with a lawsuit. But in terms of rolling in the mud, SCO pricked a worthy opponent in terms of a company that is willing to throw down with them on the mat and assert a lot of different things to make sure that it's clear that they are trying to do their best to defend against this case and not quickly settle the lawsuit. Another thing which you may or may not know about our legal system, which is important to know, is that the process of litigation is one that's largely designed to persuade people to come to their senses and settle the case. It's a very time-consuming and expensive process, and the reason is because we don't have that many courts, and we don't want to have that many courts because we as taxpayers pay for all those courts. So the idea is, let's create this system of dispute resolution that creates every incentive in the world for people to settle their disputes out of court and get their issues resolved. And usually, in the process of bringing a lawsuit, like 90% of the time, people do that, or companies do that. By the end of the day, their case probably isn't going to be heard by a court. If it's heard at a trial court level, the companies may decide after an initial decision that they don't want to keep fighting in the appellate court levels of our legal system, and they'll settle at that point. So you hear a lot about settlements. And the reason is because that's exactly the way that our system is designed to work. So the reason that's relevant is that may explain why this is taking a very long period of time, particularly when we're talking about the sum total of all these things that SCO has claimed adds up to about $5 billion worth of damages, according to SCO, at least $5 billion. They said in their complaint that we think at a minimum that all this stuff that IBM did is worth at least $5 billion in damages to SCO in terms of how much they've been harmed by IBM's alleged incorporation of parts of Unix into Linux. So let's talk briefly about these claims so you understand what's going on. Now, originally, back spring a year and a half ago, SCO focused a lot upon trade secrets misappropriation. You remember I talked a few minutes ago about how there are two basic IP rights in software that you hear a lot about. There are others, but the two big ones are trade secrets and copyright. And they started, the big gun in their lawsuit before was a trade secrets claim. They said that there are trade secrets in the source code for Unix. And those secrets didn't just involve copying literal lines of code. Those of you that are developers know that writing a good program is more than simply stringing together. It's not. There's something to how software code is organized and how it is sequenced. And that can have a lot of implications for how efficient a program is, how easy it is to figure out. And there's a lot of value in that. When a programmer sits down, a developer sits down, they look at code, one of the important things is how do they find the right parts of the code to solve the problem that they're trying to fix if there's a problem with the software. So there's this idea that there's not only value, intellectual property value, in literally the things, the lines of code in a computer program, but also in how it's all organized. Now, here's what that means in legal terms. There's this idea in a lawsuit about software piracy that you can literally steal somebody's code by copying line for line, and that's called literal copying. It's very, very easy to tell. It's a black and white issue. Did you copy the code or not? Where things start to get a little fuzzier is when you start talking about non-literal copying. And that's where the purported bad person in the lawsuit, the defendant, has, they may not have copied line for line the code, but maybe they got some idea about how to better organize their program from looking at your source code. And that's not literal copy. In other words, they didn't take a line out of it, but they learned a lot from looking at how it was organized, and that helped their program a lot. Made it a much more efficient application, made it easier for them to sell it and make money, which arguably they stole from you because they had access to your source code. And that's important. And the reason that's important is that when you talk about trade secrets, it can be both of those things. And SCO originally claimed that that was the big thing that they think that IBM had done, was they had stolen SCO's trade secrets in Unix. Now, that's dropped off the table since spring, a year and a half ago, spring of 2003. And a large reason, this is speculation, but I think the reason that's the case is that trade secrets claims in court are very difficult to bring. And the reason is because earlier I talked about what you have to prove. You have to prove that you have a secret. And it's kind of like trying to prove when the tree falls in the woods and no one's nearby to hear it. The idea is that you have to prove that no one has ever had access to your source code, or that if they did, that you did everything possible to stop them from stealing it, etc. And that's a really uphill battle. It gets really ugly in court. Think about this. Let's say that you had a secret and you walked into a court, which is a public forum. It's a place where anybody can walk in and listen, unless the judge does something like issue a protective order, which has happened in the SCO case. But you want to try and prove that that your source code, your program, has trade secrets in it. And the defendant has got every incentive to prove that your source code was not really a trade secret, that other people knew about the stuff in your code. They knew about the way it was organized. They knew about literally the lines of code within the particular program that you're trying to protect. One of the big worries that you ought to have in the back of your mind is, let's say you lose. What does that mean in terms of your ability to protect yourself in a future lawsuit if you're trying to claim that someone stole your trade secrets? What it means is that everybody's going to be able to go back to the lawsuit that you lost and say, wait a minute, in that case it was demonstrated that the trade secrets in the software were disclosed to other people. Other people in the industry knew about how you wrote your code, for instance. And at that point, you've run out of gas in terms of your ability to protect yourself with a trade secret claim in a lawsuit. So it's an uphill battle. You got to prove that you kept a secret, and that's an awfully hard thing to do. It's like trying to prove that something is true. You have to prove that all the false things are inapplicable, basically. And there are major risks if you get it wrong in the process. So SCO probably wisely basically jettisoned the trade secrets claim. So we're not going to focus on that. What they want to focus on is breach of contract. And the contracts that we're talking about are contracts that IBM signed with AT&T a long time ago that licensed to IBM the ability to use Unix and modify Unix. And the big question is whether they violated contractual obligations that I would call generally are confidentiality obligations. And that means restrictions on disclosing the code that was in Unix, as well as in using the code externally for basically external business purposes of IBM. In other words, selling it or distributing it or giving it to others, as opposed to using it internally where they might just have it sitting on a server of theirs that they just use for some back office stuff in their business. And SCO's claim, in a nutshell, boils down to IBM did more than that. SCO's claim is that IBM actually took code from Unix and ported it into Linux. And one of the big questions people have had is, what precisely are you talking about when it comes to code? And that's where you start getting into the question of fear, uncertainty, and doubt surrounding this lawsuit. And in fairness to SCO, if they really did have things in there, they probably wouldn't want to share them with the world. And the reason is because they weren't trying to protect all their rights in it. But on the other hand, if they were really trying to pull a fast one and pull the wool over everyone's eyes, they're doing exactly what they ought to be doing. So it leaves many people with this feeling of uncertainty as to whether this is a legitimate lawsuit or not. And I think the answer is we just don't know yet. And it's something that hopefully we'll learn in the course of time as the judge that's involved in the case out of Utah actually hears the evidence and finally is able to make a decision about the issues at hand. There's some other claims in the lawsuit which frankly aren't as important. There's some claims based on Utah state law about unfair competition and about how IBM has interfered with SCO's ability to form business relationships or sign contracts with other companies. SCO, by the way, also claimed that they terminated IBM's license agreements to Unix. And what that would mean is that IBM would no longer have any right to use Unix software at all, period, because the contract that gave them the right to do so had been terminated. And they said, well, IBM, after we terminated the contract, they kept using our software, and that's copyright infringement. And that's something that is also a basis for a lawsuit against IBM, according to SCO. IBM, by the way, in response, has opened up their own shotgun on SCO with, besides a lot of dispute about the facts, claiming that they didn't really take any code out of Unix and move it into Linux. And one of the things you hear regularly about are examples where SCO will claim that, well, here's an example of code or an idea in the code, maybe not literal copying, but something else, an idea, a function that was present in Unix that has been ported over to Linux by IBM. And virtually every time you hear a story about that, there'll be an immediate response from the Linux community of no, 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 no. And there are a number of different explanations about, in virtually every case, whether or not SCO has come up with a good example. And in the opinions of most of the pundits, they haven't yet, at least in public, but we're still going through the part of the lawsuit that's called discovery. And discovery is the process. Remember, I said before that the idea of our legal system is to try and force people to settle. Well, before you can settle, before you can really figure out a price in terms of how much is it going to cost me to make this lawsuit go away, you really need to be able to learn about what the other side is claiming. And that's what's going on right now. IBM is learning about what SCO's claiming and has asked a bunch of questions of SCO about, well, tell us exactly what we did that was wrong. And SCO, in turn, has got rights during this part of the lawsuit to gather more evidence to further their claims, to basically build their offensive weapons in the lawsuit. And that's where we are right now. So it's still, believe it or not, after a year and a half, it still may be too early to tell about this, about whether or not SCO has a legitimate claim against IBM. So IBM has fought on the facts. Another thing that IBM has done, they have a massive patent portfolio. It's, I think, if not the largest in the world, it's one of the largest. We're talking about thousands of patents. And one of the things that IBM can do to companies that sue them is find one of their patents that someone may have allegedly infringed and throw that into the lawsuit as a defense, a counterclaim, it's called, against the other side to say, well, yeah, maybe we did violate your rights in Unix, but by the way, you're infringing some of our patents, and you owe us a whole lot of money for that. So IBM is not, they are not just building basically a wall around themselves defensively. They've got some arrows in their quiver as well, and a big one is patent infringement. Another interesting thing that they've done relates to a license that, if you're familiar with open source software, you're probably familiar with. It's called the GPL, the General Public License. There is a great deal of software, open source software, that's licensed under the GPL. It's, I believe, the most popular open source license. And for those of you that don't know what I'm talking about, the idea generally, we could spend a lot of time talking about this that we probably don't have, and many of you probably know what I'm talking about already. Open source software is basically premised upon something very different than the usual way that people do things when they're trying to build something that they want to protect under IP laws. And the big difference is between a company that follows what I would call a traditional business model for software, and there are lots and lots of companies like that. Microsoft is one of them, but there are a lot of other companies. Apple is one of them. The idea is that you build something and you never share the source code with that product with anyone outside your company unless there's a really good reason. And companies, traditional software companies, get extremely nervous whenever any question about access to their source code comes up. The metaphor that you hear a lot is crown jewels, the idea of this is where the value of our company is all locked up in the great ideas that are present in our source code. And we're never going to share that with anyone unless they have guns, lots of guns, and they're pointed at us. And even then, we'll think about it really hard. Well, open source software is based upon a fundamentally different idea. And the idea is, generally speaking, and there are nuances and subtleties about this, it's the idea that the people that develop it really don't care too much about protecting the IP value in the software so long as the people that are using it obey a few ground rules. And this varies a lot. And that's why it's hard to talk about this generally. It varies based on the contract, the license agreement, the ground rules that people all say we should follow when we use a particular open source product. But the fundamental idea is as you gather from the name, the idea is that the source code for an open source product should be freely available to anybody that wants it. And the neat thing about that is that it allows other developers, other smart people, to look at the code and figure out ways to improve it outside of a company or outside of one particular person's mind that may be writing the code. And a lot of people think that the values of a community supporting an application or a platform are really powerful in terms of response times to problems that emerge in the code, in terms of coming up with neat ideas that should be incorporated into the particular software application or platform. And the idea is that that's a better way to write software when you're not really trying to sell it in particular. And sometimes people sell open source software. We could get lost in the details and the weeds around that. But the general idea is that let's figure out ground rules under which we'll disclose our source code for the software, and if everybody obeys the ground rules, then they can definitely have the source code, and let's all work together to make a better software program, is the general idea. Well, the GPL is an example of one of those sort of licenses that contains ground rules. And one of IBM's claims is that SCO is distributing, by the way, they've distributed Linux for a long, long time. And one of IBM's arguments is that in court, SCO has said a lot of things about how this particular open source license, the GPL, is not enforceable. They've said it's unconstitutional, which is, by the way, it's pretty rare when you find a contract, which is all a license agreement is, that's unenforceable because it's unconstitutional. I mean, think free speech, think, you know, executive branch, legislative branch. There's not a whole lot in there about contracts that are enforceable. But SCO's claim that the contract, the GPL, is unenforceable because it's unconstitutional. And IBM's response has been, well, guess what? You're in violation of our rights in certain applications that we developed under the GPL, an open source license. You've disputed that. You're in violation, IBM says. So you've got big problems for products you've been distributing for a long time. So IBM is a big company, and they are really fighting this lawsuit hard. It's a lawsuit, by the way, that is not only in terms of the amount of damages, $5 billion, massive damages. In terms of the facts and collecting all the evidence, it's a massive endeavor. In one of the articles that I've read about the case, IBM's initial list of witnesses, the people they wanted to talk to about this, was about 7,000 names long. And they've whittled it down to about 1,000 names. Think about how long it would take to find 1,000 people and depose them or talk with them in an interview, which is what a deposition is in many ways, in a more informal sense. How long it would take to not only do that, but then figure out what all these people said and then organize that in a manner so that way people can figure out how it fits into a lawsuit where you say things like you breached a contract. It's a massive endeavor. This is not a small lawsuit. There are 400 contracts between AT&T and IBM that people have had to rifle through to try and find language that's relevant to these breach of contract claims. This is a massive endeavor, and IBM is fighting it. By the way, there's a funny thing. I'm a lawyer, so this is self-deprecating, but it's kind of funny, I think. David Bowie's is his firm, and he's been involved to an extent as well as representing SCO in all this. And there are some funny things if you know a little bit about David Bowie's. The first time that most people that follow legal sort of news was back in the 70s and 80s, back when IBM was being investigated for antitrust violations by the U.S. federal government. So he previously represented IBM when he worked for a firm called Kravitz, Swain & Moore against the United States government antitrust proceedings. Well, you may remember in the Microsoft antitrust case a few years ago, David Bowie's actually took the other side of the position, which lawyers do frequently, by the way. They, you know, depending on who their client is, they can argue both sides of the law. So that's not too weird, but it is kind of funny that he was defending a massive antitrust case involving a major software company and then later turned around and prosecuted a massive antitrust case against a major software company. By the way, he's also defended against IP claims involving Napster and Amster. He's a pretty high-profile lawyer. The other funny thing about this is that his old firm is defending IBM in this lawsuit. So the man gets around. So one thing that you may be wondering about is, why isn't SCO really talking more about copyrights? I'd mentioned that there are two big ways, easy and cheap ways, that people can claim they have IP rights in software. By the way, the other thing that you hear about are patents. And patents require an application process where you have to go to a government office called the Patent and Trademark Organization. It's a lengthy process. You're looking at a minimum between $10,000 and probably $15,000 to go through that process, assuming everything goes very easily. A copyright, by the way, costs approximately $75 for you to register at the U.S. Copyright Office. You can do it. You don't need a lawyer. It's a two-page form. It's very easy to do. And you don't have to do anything with the trade secret except not tell anyone what the secret is. So you don't really have to do anything in terms of lots of expenses or talk to a lawyer like me or anyone else. So copyright is a cheap way to protect your software. Why didn't SCO talk about copyright infringement very much in this lawsuit? Well, a big reason is that they may not own the copyrights in Unix. And the reason that's the case is you may remember I talked earlier about this complicated chain, and you may be wondering why I was doing that. Well, the reason is because SCO basically bought the rights to Unix from this, not from AT&T, but from this other company called Novell. And in the contracts between SCO and Novell, there's some very ambiguous language about whether or not SCO actually bought the copyrights amongst the other stuff in the code and actually receiving a copy of the source code, etc. So probably a reason why we're not hearing a whole lot about it is because they may not own the copyrights in Unix. Now, since they initially filed the lawsuit a year and a half ago, they've taken the position that they do. But when they initially filed the lawsuit, they didn't want to talk about copyrights. And the other reason is, you remember I was talking about non-literal copying? Well, that's one of the things that SCO is worried about. In fact, this is a quote from someone who is the head of SCOsource, which is part of SCO, and he said, when IBM started utilizing the same engineers that work on the Unix Systems 5 source code and AIX, which is IBM software, they have effectively been applying R methods and concepts. That's the sort of efficiency-related things that can make software really good, but they don't necessarily involve copying a literal line of code. They've been applying R methods and concepts even if there isn't a single explicit line of code that's copied. Now, in terms of copyrights, when you get into non-literal copying, it gets really complicated and really fuzzy very quickly. And the reason is because there are a lot of limitations on what you can seek a copyright in. Earlier, I made the point, I didn't explain it very much, about how there are problems in applying old IP laws to software. And a great example of the problems that you run into in this is this. When it comes to things that you can protect with a copyright, you are not allowed by the courts to protect things that are functional, for instance. What that means is that if you build a machine or if you wrote a program, for instance, the parts of the program that serve a functional purpose as opposed to an expressive purpose, you can't get protection in it. You can't get protections in basically methods of operation. And that's largely what software is. I mean, if you think about it in the abstract, really software is a machine. It doesn't involve widgets. It doesn't involve parts or hardware necessarily. It ultimately does, of course. But when you're writing a program, it may not involve anything with respect to hardware very much. But you're basically building a machine. And the problem is that copyright laws have been around since the founding of our country to protect music, to protect art, basically, things that have massive elements of expression. And a way to think about the difference between expression and function, and it's called, the lawyers talk about the idea-expression dichotomy, which is a fancy phrase that means that you can have a great idea, but there is no way, if you just have a great idea, that you're going to be able to protect it with a copyright. You need to go file a patent and try and protect it as an invention if you just want to try and protect your idea. You can only get protection when you actually take your idea and you reduce it down to something. So a great example of what I'm talking about is that we could talk for hours about a World War II movie involving an escape from a prison of war camp in Nazi Germany. And what I just said is not protectable under the copyright laws. However, if I wrote a script for a movie for instance, let's say a television series called Hogan's Heroes, and I wrote scripts and screenplays and put a lot of work into that, I could definitely protect as expression those specific screenplays and scripts, but I would be out of luck if I walked into court and tried to get protection in the idea of a movie or a story about World War II prison camps. And that's the reason why protecting software is very hard when you talk about copyrights, unless it involves literal copying. Then it's very easy. If you've just literally taken one person's work, their idea, and you just photocopy and you take it, that's piracy, and that's pretty easy to prove. But when you start talking about the organization of things, and when you have to take out the parts of it that are ideas or functional elements of it, it gets really complicated really fast. So in addition to the problems of whether or not SCO actually owns the copyrights in Unix, the other problem is that, boy, that is a really awfully hard thing to explain to anybody in terms of being able to look at code and look at, for instance, comparing source for Unix and Linux and figuring out what ideas are similar and then remembering, oh yeah, by the way, I have to not include anything that's functional in this when software is largely written to be functional. It's a mess. So that's probably why they didn't do it. Now, by the way, that hasn't stopped SCO from trying. And in one of the more recent lawsuits against a company called AutoZone, and you may have frequented AutoZones, they have claimed that AutoZone infringed their copyrights in Unix. So they did that after they probably made the initial decisions about, do we really want to focus on this? Do we really want to talk more about our trade secrets and these other non-literal things? Maybe that's not the best vehicle for copyrights, they probably originally thought. But since then, they've taken, I'd say, a more aggressive position on this. And now they're claiming that they own the copyrights and that they've been infringed by people that are using Linux. And AutoZone is what many people consider to be the test case. And that's, in fact, what Sko has called it as well. The lawsuit against IBM is pretty unique. Not too many people actually contribute to Linux. And not too many people take, or allegedly take, parts of Unix source and incorporate that into Linux. So that's not something you're likely to see repeated. But Sko's business model, largely at this point, is to try and get people to pay them license fees, get them to pay them money so to stop Sko from suing them. And the case against AutoZone is an example of that. And we'll see where it goes. We'll talk about that a little later in our time together. Why not patents? Well, on Unix, that will be a problem. And the reason is because patents are a very powerful weapon when it comes to stopping people from stealing your idea or your invention. And they're so powerful that the courts and the laws have this time limitation on them. They only last at most 20 years from the day that you originally filed a patent. Unix, rather, is very, very old. So it would be very hard for Sko to do that. So in addition to that, by the way, Novell, the company that once owned Unix, has also claimed that they did not transfer the patents to Unix over to Sko. So they may not even own them. So that's why you don't hear too much about patents in this particular lawsuit. Now, most of the claims that I was talking about before, trade secrets, no more, breach of contract, Utah state law claims, that's all state-based legal stuff, which usually would stay in a state court. But because the lawsuit is really, really large, it's the kind of lawsuit that could be heard in a federal court. And in fact, that's where it's being heard, by a judge named Kimball out in Utah, their home court, basically, which is where Sko is based. Currently, the trial date for this case is set for November of 2005, a long time from now, at least a year away before we'd actually see a trial. And right now, where we are, I mentioned earlier, we're in the discovery phase. And the other thing that's occurring is there's this thing called summary judgment. And it's actually important to know what that is in this context if you're curious about why on earth things are taking so long. And this is one of the ways that our courts are designed to keep people out of court, basically, unless they're really, really mad and really, really want to have a fight in court. And the idea is that if the lawsuit is basically a slam dunk for either side, if there isn't a dispute about the facts, for instance, in the lawsuit, then it's never going to get into court. The judge will look at a motion for summary judgment that can be brought by either side, where each side will say, this case is a slam dunk. There isn't any question about the facts about what IBM did, or in turn IBM could say, there isn't any question about what we did that, or what we didn't do in this case. And this case shouldn't even be heard in court. So right now, both sides are basically in that phase. They're collecting evidence, trying to find out what really happened, and they're also preparing, and in fact, IBM just filed earlier this month, a motion for summary judgment. And to give you an idea of the complexity of this case and how big it is, the motion that they filed to try and say this is a slam dunk for IBM was 100 pages long. You could spend your life reading the documents in this case. I haven't had all that much time to do that, but I do follow the case, and it is rather interesting. And by the way, if you are curious about the lawsuit, there is a great website that follows all the Sko cases in excruciating detail. Some of you, or many of you, may know what it is. It's Groklaw, GROKLAW.net. And there is so much information available. It's lawsuits generally, I don't think, make good hobbies, but if you really need a hobby and you're interested, that's a great place to go. So what's going on with Novell? Well, Novell first got wind of this when they received one of these form letters from Sko that said, you're infringing our rights in Unix, which they thought was a little bit funny because they owned it for a while, and they were a little surprised by that. And they went back to their books and their contracts, talked to their lawyers, and said, you know, we didn't really ever think that we gave up some of the rights in Unix, the copyrights and the patents. Now, I've had a chance, and these documents, by the way, are public. Novell has made them public. You can read them. And the judge in the Sko case involving Sko and Novell, and I'll mention that a little later in our time together, has basically confirmed what my reading of it, which is the contracts are horribly unclear as to whether or not this happened. And you might wonder, why exactly, how does that happen? How is it that you can basically sell someone code? And I don't know how much Sko paid Novell for it, but it probably wasn't cheap. And there are, you know, smart lawyers on both sides of that deal, writing the contracts, drafting the contracts, trying to explain exactly what it was that Sko was buying. You might wonder, how could they just mess that up? That's so important. And the reason probably has to do with a frequent phenomenon you see in negotiations, which is ultimately when people can't agree, what they try and do is they come up with a compromise. And sometimes, in terms of contracts, those compromises can take the form of language that is a little unclear. And you look at the language, you say, I think I can live with this because this is what I think it means. And the other side says, well, I look at that language and I think I can live with it because I read it differently than they do, but I think we'd win if there would ever be a dispute about that language. And I'm guessing that's probably what happened in the sale of Unix from Novell to SCO, is they had disputes about what rights are being transferred. And as a result, we have this contract that's very ambiguous. The judge in the case, it's the same judge that's hearing the Novell lawsuit, that's also hearing the IBM lawsuit, he looked at the contract and said, this is not a slam dunk. This is really confusing. And if you all want to continue with this lawsuit, this is the kind of thing that we just can't simply resolve by filing briefs against each other. We're going to need to hear evidence about this to try and figure out what exactly was meant by this language. So anyway, it's not clear whether or not Novell is right. It's not clear whether SCO is right based on just reading the contract. It's really, really ambiguous. So where does Microsoft fit in all this? You hear their name frequently involving all this. They, by the way, have bought one of those licenses from SCO to Unix. And there have just been, by the way, a handful of companies that have done that. In fact, SCO is a publicly traded company, which means they have to reveal a lot of information about themselves on a quarterly basis. So that way their investors, people like you and me, if we want to invest in SCO, know what's going on with the company. And the answer is that not a whole lot in terms of license revenue. They spent, I think, earlier this year in a three-month period, they paid the lawyers, and not just the lawyers, but they're, in other words, they're not just paying a lawyer's salary, but there's a lot of expense in talking to thousands of witnesses, finding all the evidence, finding experts who actually can read source and compare Linux versus Unix source code. There's just a massive amount of expense in a lawsuit this size. They spent, I think it was between $3 and $4 million in the expenses for this lawsuit, this massive lawsuit. And they only generated, in terms of license revenue, it was, I believe, a scale of either tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars. And that's it. And Microsoft is one of those companies that's bought a license from SCO. Others include Computer Associates and some other smaller companies that have also bought licenses. But there haven't been all that many that have leapt to pay SCO money to keep them off their back. Microsoft made a big deal about the license that they bought. And one thing that you may have figured out about this, and something we'll talk a little bit in a few minutes about, is that Microsoft has a lot to gain from this lawsuit. And the reason is because they sell operating systems, Windows primarily. Linux is a threat to them because it's cheap, it's easy, it spreads like wildfire. It's very easy to find copies of Linux. You don't need to go to a store, you don't need to go to a company to buy it, a distributor. It's very easy to find copies of it. A lot of companies do buy it from traditional sources, but it's a lot less expensive than Microsoft's applications and platforms. And they've been really worried about open source software as a threat to their business. So they stand to benefit from this particular controversy. Sun is another. Sun's kind of more complicated because they also actually distribute forms of they may distribute Linux. I believe they do, but
they're coming out with a version of Linux.
So it's, Sun's more complicated. They're a hardware company that also sells software, so they're not. It's not as clear as to the extent they benefit compared to Microsoft, for instance. But there have been a lot of allegations about Microsoft's role behind the scenes in terms of helping SCO find big investors to basically help to fund this lawsuit. And the fact that they can is pretty interesting. There's a lot of speculation about what that means, and we don't need to get into that, I don't think, given our time. So let's talk about all this. What is this? Is this legitimate IP, or is this fear, uncertainty, and doubt? And I think the answer, and I've alluded to this before, is we don't know yet. And so far, SCO has not made any what I would call a critical misstep, where they've shown their hand, so to speak. If they had a legitimate claim, they're doing everything they ought to be doing. If this was basically an attempt to scare people, they're doing the things that they ought to be doing. And it's hard for people to understand that and to understand how slow our legal system is, which is intentional, because our courts don't have time for all the lawsuits. So they want to slow this stuff down, keep it as out of our system as possible in terms of the amount of time that it takes judges to hear cases. So that's the reason. And the funny thing about this is that I'd say perhaps in the past 5 or 10 years, more than any other time in the history of the world, information moves very, very fast. And the media moves very, very fast. And we expect fast results in everything we do. And the fact that this cloud has been hanging over Linux for a year and a half just seems like an eternity for a lot of people. And a lot of the reporters that cover stories like this, they're bored because there isn't a lot of news about this, because the lawsuit is taking so long, and they're not going to get to court till at least November of next year. So a lot of people are really tired of hearing about this, and that may be one of the reasons why SCO is not really getting a lot of traction in terms of selling people licenses for their software. Shotguns versus rifles. What I mean by that point is this. If a lot of people, when they approach a lawsuit and they're really serious about it, they really want people to focus on one particular claim. And SCO isn't really doing that. They're basically using a shotgun, this thing. They're throwing a lot of different legal claims into the mix, many different arrows in their quiver. And that's an unusual thing to do. But it doesn't mean that they're necessarily wrong. It's just something that's a little unusual. There are a lot of things that we have yet to learn about the lawsuit. It's hard because there is a protective order in place, and that, by the way, is something that happens whenever you've got a situation where there's information that's sensitive, and that could be personal information, for instance. You've probably heard of John Doe lawsuits. You can also have sensitive intellectual property, and in cases like that, judges can issue protective orders, and that's exactly what the judge has done in this case. So a lot of the evidence, the lines and lines, the millions of lines, I don't know if billions, but millions of lines of code in this case, will never see the light of day. And that's to protect any rights that SCO may actually have in the software. And they, by the way, there's little question that they own something in Unix. That's not really in dispute at all. The question is whether or not IBM did anything wrong. Now, IBM is going to argue that they have a license to Unix and they didn't do anything wrong, and we're not likely to see a whole lot of evidence ultimately, but we will ultimately see either a decision or a settlement. And so far, we haven't seen any inkling that IBM wants to settle this case. They are slinging it right back at SCO. So it's not the kind of thing that you do if you want to quickly get something out of court and resolve it. They are really fighting this thing, which suggests that a settlement probably won't happen anytime soon. But you never know. They may, at the end of the year or at some particular arbitrary date they've chosen, decide this is still going on. SCO has offered us a really small amount to settle this case. We'll just get rid of it because we don't want to keep fighting this thing and paying all the massive expenses we have to pay to keep this lawsuit going. So some other things to keep in mind about this is copyright probably not going to be a big deal in the case. The case is probably going to turn on these contract clauses about confidentiality. It's probably going to be the meat of this case when it finally gets settled. A lot of speculation about whether or not on the FUD side, whether this is all just basically a strategy by SCO's part to get acquired, get bought by somebody else. And the theory goes as this. This is definitely what some call bet the company litigation. The idea is that if they lose this lawsuit, they are done. And the reason that's true that I haven't mentioned yet, in addition to the massive expense, and they think they have enough money to keep fighting this thing at least through the trial, which is going to take about 5 weeks, so the end of 2005, they think they've got enough money to get through that period of time and fight off and appeal if they lose, etc. But they've really made a lot of people mad, and you may be, in fact, one of those people. There's been a tremendous amount of antipathy they've generated in the Linux community. All these people that are using this software that's really efficient, works very well, is a lot more stable than the alternatives out there, and they're very happy with their software. And the idea that it may violate someone else's rights, that the software that you're using on your server, on your PC, the fact that it's got code in it that someone else owns, is really threatening to a lot of people. And they're pretty worried about this. So the fact that SCO would just antagonize everyone in the world that they could potentially sell a license to is a reason why some people think that they really don't intend to do that. And what this is really all about is an attempt to get acquired and maybe persuade some buyer that there's enough in this lawsuit, enough evidence that they have in this lawsuit, they think something really happened, that someone could essentially buy the lawsuit. And the theory would be that the value of the company as an asset is that they might win. So whether or not that's true is something that we really don't know, but that's a theory out there. Another theory, by the way, a defense, and in fact IBM mentioned this in that motion that I mentioned a little earlier, is that SCO has been a Linux distributor for a long time, and one of the big problems with that is that arguably that means that they've waived their ability to sue IBM because they've been distributing the same software. They've been handing out copies of software that contains their stuff, which they claim IBM allegedly stole from them, which is a problem. That's probably not going to be the ringer, like the thing that ends the lawsuit. It might be One of the reasons, by the way, and yet another reason why our legal system encourages people to settle is that there's a whole lot of certainty when you sign a contract with somebody that says, we're not going to sue each other anymore over this particular matter. It's done. And you know the price tag, you know how much it costs, and that's it. And when you talk about a judge or a jury, you just don't know what they're going to do. And I could be wrong. The judge in the case could decide, this is the issue. They've been selling this for years. It's over. SCO is lost. Whether he'll do that, we don't know. We'll have to wait and see. $5 billion is a lot of money, by the way, and that's something that is, I think, scared a whole lot of people about this particular lawsuit. I don't think you'll see a whole lot of lawsuits from SCO suing other companies for that amount of money. The way they've allocated it, by the way, there are about four different contracts, four groups of contracts involving IBM and a company that IBM bought. And they've basically allocated about $1 billion to each of those four. And then there's one of these state law, these claims of unfair competition. They've said that's worth at least $1 billion. And that, by the way, is the floor. That's not the ceiling. They've said that there are other claims that we have, some of this other, the other arrows in our quiver. They could also be worth a whole lot of money, but we really just don't know how much it's going to be yet. We need to talk to people that know, that could make estimates, for instance, about how much money that we could have made, SCO could have made, if Linux wasn't around and people were buying Unix licenses from SCO as opposed to buying Linux licenses. So, anyway, what does that mean for users? Well, I mentioned earlier, you or your company may have received one of these letters. SCO, by the way, will let you look at the code and look at some of the lines of code that they think infringe code lines in Unix that have allegedly been copied in Linux, as well as how it's organized, the non-literal things I was talking about. But you need to sign a non-disclosure agreement with SCO to do that, which the one big thing that you probably, if you're a developer, you know this. One of the reasons why the Linux community would really like to see the code is they just want to fix this problem and move on and get on with their lives. And if SCO has paid a whole lot of money for this as an asset, they have no incentive at all to just let somebody fix the problem because they want to get paid, basically. They think that they've been harmed and they want to get paid. So I haven't seen any NDAs along these lines from SCO, but it wouldn't surprise me if that NDA said, you can't use what you've learned from looking at our source code for Unix and use that to write a patch for Linux to basically excise the code that's infringing and basically write code that doesn't. I'd be willing to bet that that NDA probably would not allow that to happen. So that, by the way, that theme of we just want to know what the problem is, which is the expression that you hear from the Linux community, and SCO's response of we're not going to tell you, is one of the main reasons that people think that this lawsuit may be all about fear, uncertainty, and doubt. And the problem is that it really does cut both ways. If this was a legitimate lawsuit, SCO's doing exactly what any other traditional software company would do, which is to say, we're not going to let you get off the hook just by fixing the problem. You owe us a lot of money, and we want you to pay us for that. And we're not going to let you just write a little patch for the problem. So, non-open source platform vendors, Sun, Microsoft, others, benefit from all this lawsuit. But a major thing that gets lost, unfortunately, in the weeds and all the in the what I would call almost the noise that you hear about this lawsuit, not so much on a daily basis anymore, is that you know underneath all this, there really is a legitimate point, and it's something to keep in mind about open source software, is that the idea that when you have this community, everyone working together on code, that is a great model when it comes to things like efficiency and scale and getting great minds together to work on a problem. But the problem is that you may not know who these people are. And you don't know where they got the code that they're incorporating in the software. And that's the fundamental thing. I think it's almost one of the elements of neuroses in the Linux community is that whole idea is so frustrating that people get very angry about this lawsuit. And at a fundamental level, let's not talk about SCO for a second. That's true. I mean, for all you know, when you use open source software, some bad person, some malevolent person could incorporate something in there that is somebody else's code. And the only way you're going to find out about it is when that other person steps forward and says, that's mine and that's in here, and let's get rid of it and fix the problem or work it out through a license, et cetera, et cetera. But that's true. And that's a risk with using open source software is that you just don't know who owns it because it comes from many, many different sources. And tracking down who actually contributed a particular line of code may be possible, but may not be possible in all circumstances. By the way, if you are thinking about writing, if you work for a company or startup and you're thinking about writing a software application, that's going to be your business, you need to be really careful about open source software. Depending on what the license says, you might lose your rights in the parts of the software that you write as opposed to everybody else that's contributing to the open source software. And that's something to just keep in mind. You, if you think that the software is valuable and you plan on selling it to a lot of other people and trying to protect your IP rights, and you think that'll attract investors in the company, be really careful about open source software. By the way, there is a very interesting study that you may or may not have heard about that came out this month. It's from this outfit called Open Source Risk Management, and they're a company that's selling insurance about open source software, IP insurance, believe it or not, actually. And IP insurance has been around for a little while. It's very expensive, and the reason is because, particularly when you talk about patents, it is an area where it's hard to quantify the risk. The way that insurance companies make money is that they're really good at generally predicting the risk of bad things happening to companies or people, and they have models, and it's a very sophisticated business. And they figure out how much it would cost to fix the problem, the risk of a problem occurring, how much it costs to fix it. They make a little bit of money between those costs and what they think you should pay them, and that's how they work. And the problem, particularly when it comes to patents, is the two things I talked about earlier about IP. I talked about how there are trade secrets and copyright. And to prove those things, one thing that was implicit when I said is that for someone to violate those kinds of rights, they have to basically steal your stuff. At some point, they have had to have had access to your source code in a software setting and take it and do something with it. And to violate somebody's patent rights, you do not need to have access to their stuff. You can violate somebody's patent simply by practicing an invention that happens to fall within the meets and bounds, is the legal phrase, the scope of the patent that they have. And this outfit called Open Source Risk Management did a study. They looked at Linux, and they concluded that the kernel for Linux may infringe. They don't know, and the reason is because patents are kind of speculative. You never know whether or not they're actually going to stand the test of a courtroom until they actually get into court. They said there are 283 different patents that are out there, and it's quite possible that Linux infringes at least some of them, and they said we think it may infringe all of those patents. 27 of those patents, by the way, are owned by Microsoft, a large company that has every reason in the world to want Linux to die very quickly. Whether or not they would actually sue anyone is very questionable, because it's generally a bad idea, and I don't mean this to sound overly simplistic, but it's a really bad idea to sue people that are going to be your customers, which may be a reason why Microsoft may not do that, but other companies that may have a legitimate claim may not see the world that way. IBM, by the way, owns a bunch of these patents. They've said we would never do that. They are big proponents of Linux at this point. But anyway, so the point being behind that example is that there are a lot of IP rights that are at issue whenever you have open source. Every single person that contributes code can be potentially taking it from somewhere else. They may have their own rights in it. And whether or not they're doing the right thing in terms of making sure that anything that they contribute is really just theirs and not somebody else's really is honor system. And that can be very expensive when it comes to lawsuit, unfortunately. So what do you do? Open source software is, a lot of people think it's really cheap, it's really effective, it's very stable, it changes a lot, and that's good. How do you solve these problems? And the answers are, fighting it out in court is one solution, but a very expensive one. There are other solutions, and in fact, the first one is called an indemnity, which is a legal word that means basically a shield. It's a shield against a lawsuit, in essence. And a couple companies have stepped forward to offer shields against SCO suing their companies. In other words, if you buy Linux from a distributor like HP, then HP has said, we will protect you from the cost of that lawsuit. I've looked at some of the language for some of those indemnities. I don't recall which companies, but you know, they're not 100%. They're not ironclad. You need to be careful just upon relying upon someone saying, hey, we'll protect you. That's a case where if you're really worried about these kinds of problems, that is a good time to talk to a lawyer who can look at that language and figure out what it means and figure out if it really does adequately protect you. Unfortunately, it may not. It may. Another option is don't use open source. You know, consider this as a factor in your pro-con list of what are the advantages? What's the cost versus the benefit of using open source as opposed to a proprietary alternative? This is something to consider. The fact that the open source application or platform or whatever it is, the program, may infringe somebody else's rights is a risk. And you know, you just have to factor that into thinking about it. And finally, there is insurance out there. And that outfit I just mentioned is apparently selling some. I don't know anything about them. And I can tell you that IP insurance can be very expensive. But if you're really worried about these risks, you're scared about them, you've got reasons to be particularly worried about them, that's an option out there. But you won't, by the way, you won't probably find IP insurance from just any old company. There aren't a lot of insurance companies that offer it. And the reason is because it's really hard for them to figure out the risk of an IP lawsuit arising. They've got models for things like slipping and falling on banana peels and car collisions and all this stuff that's been around for a long time. But IP risks are really difficult to quantify. So the premiums on IP insurance are pretty high. So let's talk briefly about these other lawsuits. And the bottom line as to most of these is that they're all in a holding pattern based on what happens between SCO and IBM. And things probably won't happen very quickly in that lawsuit, so there won't be a whole lot of news about these lawsuits anytime soon. Red Hat is a major distributor of Linux. And they have sued SCO, actually. They've gone on the offensive. And their offensive is what's called a declaratory action. They basically try to take the offensive and say, we think there's a good probability that we're going to get sued by SCO, and we don't think we've done anything wrong. And we want to get a little bit ahead of the curve here and just get into court and start establishing our defenses. And that hasn't moved very quickly because the judges basically, in fact, in the first three lawsuits, the Novell lawsuit being the same judge that's involved in the IBM claim, he's basically just said, let's wait. Let's see how things proceed with IBM. Let's see the evidence that comes out in that case, etc. SCO has sued Novell for slander, which is defamation. And the reason they did that was because Novell said, you don't own the copyrights. And SCO said, you know, you're basically damaging our business reputation for saying that. So they've sued Novell in front of the same judge that's here in the IBM case. So he's hearing a lot from SCO. The third case is this. I'd mentioned this earlier. This is almost the model. And SCO has said this is the model for the future for us if they have a future, if this all proceeds the way they want it to, which is we're going to go out and sue companies that use Linux. And they've sued them for copyright infringement, which is relatively simple. As things go in lawsuits, they don't have in other words, SCO doesn't have a contract with AutoZone that they can point to. So pretty much one of the few ways they could go out and sue companies that use Linux is copyright infringement. Now, the judge in that case, it's being heard in Nevada, said, hold off on this. Let's see what happens with IBM. Not sure that SCO really has a claim here yet. We just need to wait and see. Now, another lawsuit, which you may have heard about, this is kind of in some ways an amusing lawsuit, involved a small company called Daimler Chrysler. Daimler received one of these letters, but theirs was a little different. This lawsuit did not involve, and I say did not involve Linux, involved Unix. Daimler Chrysler, and Chrysler originally, is one of those companies that used industrial strength Unix for a long period of time. And SCO sent them a letter and said, under our contract, you have to tell us a lot of things about how you're using Unix. Tell us now how you're using Linux. Tell us where it is, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And Daimler Chrysler is a big company. They didn't respond quick enough for SCO. So as opposed to picking up the phone, calling them and saying, hi, we sent you this letter, what's going on? They sued them. Now, when Daimler Chrysler lawyers arrived in court, they said, this is the lawsuit was the basis for the lawsuit from SCO against Daimler Chrysler was a Unix contract. So they got out the contract and they looked at the contract and the contract said, okay, when you receive a letter from SCO and it didn't say how fast they have to respond, you have to tell them these five things about where the software is, et cetera. So they arrive at court and they say, well, we haven't used Unix in 7 years anywhere in our company. And they asked us for a whole lot of things that aren't in this list of five things that the contract says. There are like 13, I'm making that number up, 13 things in the letter that SCO sent us. So how does that breach our contract over Unix? It's, you know, there's no breach there. And by the way, there's no time limit in the contract. How can SCO say that we had to respond in a particular bit of time in the contract and say how fast we have to respond? So the judge ruled on this case in July and didn't completely shut it down, but in effect has. And as I understand it, the remaining issue is whether or not SCO can prove that they were damaged by how quickly Daimler Chrysler responded to the letter of notice. A hard thing to do. And in fact, a spokesperson for SCO has basically said the lawsuit is probably pretty much over at this point. A funny thing about I believe it was the AutoZone lawsuit. Those of you that use Microsoft Word a whole lot may know something about a track changes feature in the product. And what it basically allows you to do is look at changes that people make to a document. You can turn it on and turn it off. And someone at SCO turned it on and then hid the changes before they sent out the complaint. And I believe it was an AutoZone. And a journalist looked at the document and they said, I wonder if there are any changes in here, and turned on the feature. And sure enough, Bank of America's name was crossed out and where AutoZone's name was, which made it very clear that SCO was thinking about suing Bank of America. Nothing has come of that. It was a bit of a surprise. It's possible they'll file a lawsuit. We'll see. But it's an interesting track record we have here. And it's an interesting lawsuit. It'll be curious to see how it plays out. It's still too early to tell, unfortunately, as to whether or not SCO has a legitimate claim. But they are doing their darndest to fight this fight. And we'll see who wins, IBM or SCO. And that's it. I'll be glad to take any questions. Yes.
Challenges you mentioned resulting from wanting to choose something else besides open source because of the possibility that some intellectual property has been incorporated into your software, you can scratch the word open source from that. That's true for all software. So there's no reason to pick out and pick on open source for all those issues.
The difference is, it's a very good point. You're right. In terms of factually, the fact that someone, even someone that you license, Microsoft, for instance, not to pick on them, but just anybody, if I was selling a software, I could have made a mistake or intentionally included somebody else's stuff. The difference is, in cases where you have a contract, where you paid money to somebody for software and you got a contract, if it's a good contract, it'll include protections against that benefit you that protect... would require me to protect you if a lawsuit was ever filed against you. And that's the big difference. You're right, though, factually. But the difference is that if you're dealing with a company that you're buying software from, hopefully if they have a good contract with you, you would have some protections there against that kind of problem.
But the same thing could be true if I bought Linux and got a support contract from IBM. So that's doesn't change. Open source is not part of that equation at all, so I'm just being a little unfair towards open source.
Yeah, with respect, I do think it is fair. It is fair to say that if you, in fact, what I deal with software contracts all the time, and a big difference is that in terms of factually, you're right, and in terms of risk analysis, a point is that you're right. I mean, anyone could include, there are always pirates out there, there are always bad people. That's true. The difference is that if you're buying software from a company, let's say a big company, if they have a fair contract to you, it will contain protections that if you ever got a letter in the mail from someone, you would send it to them and say, take care of me. And the problem would go away.
But that's true, open source or non-open source.
It's no, it's not.
Packages out of the equation.
No, it is not true. Under most open source licenses, there isn't somebody that you can call to say, I've been sued, help me against this. With some distributors that I mentioned, HP and others, they're offering programs like that. And that's true about that. But it's not true across the board for all open source software.
Nor closed source software. So,
true.
Again, that factors out of the equation again. It doesn't matter that it's open source versus closed source.
Well, we can talk about that later. Let's talk about other questions. I think the question is going to be, does Microsoft protect people against these kind of problems in their end user agreements? And the answer is, in some of them they do. I haven't reviewed them. Microsoft's got thousands of contracts. But in some of them they do.
Not in the Windows 98 CD I opened.
That may be. So, yeah, it wouldn't surprise me. I mean, it goes to the contract, and it depends on the specific relationship you have with the vendor. And some vendors don't do what I would call the right thing, but some do. So it depends.
Yeah, I don't want to change the subject, so I'm just weigh in on that subject a little bit. So where I work at IBM, before we ship a product, we have to go through a very lengthy process called a certificate of originality, in which we track down every programmer who wrote every line of code and make them, you know, attest to this is an original work, et cetera, et cetera. And no, I didn't, you know, crib it off some open source site someplace, right? So proprietary companies do have processes in place to do this sort of thing, to at least give their internal lawyers some assurance that everything they're shipping is an original work. What I think is relevant here is that the open source community hasn't been doing that. And it's just the point that you made. You don't know that, you know, somebody sends some code to a committer in Linux. You know, in the past there hasn't been a process in place for the committer to ensure that the code that's being donated is not subject to some other IP restrictions. But the Linux people are starting to put this process in place, and I know for a fact that the Apache Software Foundation is putting this into place. So if you want to propose a project to Apache or donate a bunch of code to Apache, they're now putting processes in place where you have to attest that that code is effectively an original work and it doesn't have IP considerations associated. So the way I look at it is, this is an example of the open source community growing up and recognizing that such IP issues exist, and we're going to have to deal with them. And that's just the bottom line.
Good point.
I just wanted to let you know that SCO actually said any derivatives of Unix. That meant BSD, like Randall runs, or Linux, was viable for attack by them. And I know you had up there, you know, possibly SCO being bought out. Who else better than IBM? You know, the biggest company. So that's, you know, and I'm waiting to hear to find out what's going on with the SCO SUSE or SCO Novell. Because, you know, SUSE and SCO had a business agreement, and SCO broke that agreement when they filed those lawsuits. So
we'll see. Other questions? Just one in the back.
Hi, thank you. My question is more from a standpoint of litigation. And what has the court system been doing to aid themselves with interpreting the technology that's since it's new and developing? Are they using their own expert witnesses, or how are they following the new technology?
That's a great question. The answer in a nutshell is that they've really tried to put that back in the companies and the people that come before them with a lawsuit, and to try and make sure that those companies and people bring experts that can explain things to the judges and juries to try and help these things get explained to them in a way that makes sense to them. But that's a huge issue with lawsuits, and it's part of the risk factor whenever you go to court is the person that's hearing the lawsuit, are they qualified? Do they have the necessary background? And that's a big deal for the lawyers is when they try and figure out the right place to bring a lawsuit is, can we find someone that really has got the right background to hear the case? But it's a problem. Any other questions?
Okay. I wanted to maybe part of a question, part comment. It seems to me that there's a certain inequity with open source software because there may be more IP infringement in proprietary software that's closed source, but open source is, because it's open, it's more susceptible to examination and it's more susceptible to these sorts of claims. So, do you see that inequity there, and do you think there ought to be a way to redress that in the legal system? That's really almost a policy question.
Yeah, it's a good question. And by the way, a comment about this, and in terms of my beliefs about this, I love open source software. You know, my point is that there are risks, and as the gentleman from IBM said, you know, it's a really good idea when there are risks and they're big to do something about it, and that doesn't mean that you throw the baby out with the bathwater. So I also like proprietary software as well. The question is to whether the opacity, how easy it is to look at the code and whether that makes a difference. My opinion is to this specific issue. There are a lot of issues that you think about in terms of open source versus proprietary. But as to this, I really do think that the classic model of a company that's writes their own code, knows the employees, knows where they are, and makes them all sign documents in blood saying they know, you know, that it was all their code, that model has presented fewer risks. There are certainly cases that have come up. It would be silly to say that there aren't IP lawsuits that involve companies that generate proprietary software. But there have been fewer of them, and it's easy. You know who you're dealing with, and it's the who factor that is in the abstract an issue. But I think the challenge is that open source is such an abstract concept in terms of what program we're talking about, any processes that may be in place by the team working on it, by the community to try and control how the code enters in. It's so hard to talk about it in generals. But, I mean, in the abstract, I would say companies that have a very tight model for controlling their code, they have fewer IP problems, but they still may have some. You know, I take risks all the time. I walk across streets, and I'm glad I do. And IP risks are risks. They're not reasons in and of themselves not to do something unless there's piracy involved, and you know it, and you may go to jail for that. But outside of situations like that, it's a risk, and you just need to factor that into your thinking about whether or not open source is the way to go.
Hi. My question for you is, if you're starting a company tomorrow and you had to choose some, IT, platform to put all your stuff on top of, when you evaluate that risk, would you personally feel like it's safe to go with Linux?
That's a good question. It would depend. I mean, I could see a company making the decision that Linux is the way to go. It depends on the trouble is when you're starting a business, there are a lot of factors that go into it. The variables could include who are your customers going to be, what do they use, and for a business, being able to sell things is pretty much the driver. So if all of your customers use Linux, then I would consider the risk and say maybe in this case it's a risk worth taking for me, but I could see someone reaching a different conclusion. Someone might conclude, I don't want to get in this business. This stuff worries me. I don't want to deal with legal risks. I don't like them. I don't like lawyers because it's complicated and et cetera. So, I mean, in other words, what I'm saying is that, you know, I could see someone coming to the conclusion that writing on top of Linux is the way to go because that's what their customers use. So they've got to use it if they want to have a business. So that makes sense to me, but it really does depend on a lot of facts beyond this one issue. So a lot of complex questions going on with business development, basically. Good question, though.
Are open source and proprietary mutually exclusive?
No. And that's... We could talk for hours and days about the ways that the two can combine and... So the answer is no, they're not. In fact, you can get into situations where someone will develop a proprietary application like Apple, and they take parts of open source applications or programs and incorporate them into their proprietary thing. Apple, their wrapper, their GUI is proprietary, but the kernel is not. It's BSD, basically. So yeah, you can mix them. And that makes it even more confusing figuring out how all this stuff plays out. But yeah, you can.
In the web of usage, for example, looking at AutoZone, where is there a defined line below which the usage doesn't cut? For example, can SCO sue every user of Linux for infringement, even if they make no money off of it? Can SCO sue every person who goes into AutoZone for participating in a process which contributes to the usage, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera?
Great question. Where does it stop? The answer in AutoZone is that if you didn't use their computers, you're not going to get sued. The flip side is that if you use Linux and you believe everything that SCO's saying here, and then yeah, conceivably SCO could sue Linux users. There's this practicality called cost, which means that SCO and virtually every other company like this that has a claim against individuals, think the music business, they can't sue everybody. They've got to pick and choose. So they're going to pick priorities, and you know that's how they do things. You know, who's high profile, who are the really bad people that we really want to stop from doing things that are wrong, etc. So they can't sue everybody. They would go out of business. Yes, and they will scare people. Anyone would do that. That's what, you know, what's going on in the music industry right now. So yes, another good example. Other questions?
I have kind of a big picture question. It seems like the SCO thing going on in the RIAA and the MPA and a lot of other instances is all this intellectual property war stuff going on in the country right now. Do you see this as coming to some kind of a head in the future with other than just like the lobbyists for the big companies screwing us over even more?
Right. Great question. You know what's underneath it all? I think more than anything, it's internet. And that's what I think is so exciting about the time in which we live. I mean, what's unique is these rights have been around forever. Software hasn't been around forever. It's been around for a pretty long period of time. What's different is that it's really easy for things to get copied and distributed around the world very fast. And that's a threat to a lot of traditional businesses. And they're trying to figure it out. I'm not sure they're making the right choices. I think that ultimately it'll settle down. But there's always going to be this, you know, element of piracy that frustrates traditional business owners that are really, you know, good, honest people who are trying to develop products and, you know, see their stuff being stolen. To set aside examples of big industries that are really not doing the right thing by their customers. But yeah, so the answer is, I think it's something that we'll see get worked out probably over the next 10 years. It will not be a quick, easy thing. And Congress is involved in this. A brief anecdote, there was a law passed called the Digital Millennium Copyright Act about 5-6 years ago now. 1998, passed the Senate, I believe, unanimously. And I watched the bill very closely, and no one was talking about the kinds of things that that law has been used for when it was passed. I mean, no one saw it coming. People are talking about cable descrambler boxes. And I mean, that was what the example. You know, no one wants to, you know, protect the people running cable piracy, basically. And well, see where we are. You know, it's I think caused Congress to be much more cautious about passing laws very rapidly regarding technological change. And I think that's probably a very good thing.
You do mean no one in Congress was talking about that, right?
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. I mean, yeah, other people were, but it wasn't the part of the debate going on there. I mean, no one was talking before Congress saying this is way too broad. It wasn't reaching their ears, at least in the public debates. And it's, in retrospect, a shame. Any other questions? Great. I enjoyed our time. Thanks. Enjoy the con.